Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Kelly Jean Kelly, and Jill Robbins. Later, we will bring you our American history program, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Kelly Jean Kelly.
Students and neighbors describe the suspect in the Florida high school shooting as a troubled teenager. They said he threatened and harassed other students. He talked about killing animals, and he shared photos of himself on social media, posing with guns. On Wednesday, Nicholas Cruz killed 17 people and injured another 16. He used a semi-automatic rifle, an AR-15, at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Cruz had been expelled from the school for disciplinary reasons, the county sheriff said. Math teacher Jim Gard told the Miami Herald that before Wednesday's fatal shooting, Cruz may have been identified as a potential threat. There were problems with him last year threatening students, and I guess he was asked to leave campus, Gard told the paper.
Student Victoria Olvera said Cruz had been abusive to his ex-girlfriend. She said he was expelled after a fight with another boy. School officials said Cruz had been attending a different nearby school since his expulsion. Cruz was an orphan. His father died many years ago, and his mother died last November. Cruz lived with family friends in Broward County, north of Miami. A lawyer for the family said they knew that Cruz owned the AR-15, but they made him keep it locked up in a cabinet. He did have the key, however. The lawyer, Jim Lewis, told the Associated Press the family had no idea that anything could be wrong with Cruz. He said Cruz is just a mildly troubled kid who'd lost his mom. He totally kept this from everybody.
An official in Broward County told CNN that Cruz was getting treatment at a mental health clinic. But he had not been there for more than a year. Some students said they recognized Cruz from an Instagram photo. In it, he is posing with a gun in front of his face. The students called him weird and a loner. One of the students said he was not surprised officials had identified Cruz as the shooter. I think everyone had in their minds, if anybody was going to do it, it was going to be him. The city mayor said teachers had tried to help Cruz make connections at school, but they had not succeeded, he said. School official Robert Runcie said Cruz had not previously warned the school of an attack. He said, there weren't any phone calls or threats that we know of that were made.
On Thursday morning, Cruz was charged with 17 counts of premeditated murder. And the shooting in Florida became the fourth deadliest school shooting in modern U.S. history.
I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
South Africa's parliament has chosen Cyril Ramaphosa as the country's new president. Ramaphosa was elected by the parliament without a vote in Cape Town, the legislative capital. South Africa's Chief Justice told lawmakers that Ramaphosa was the only candidate nominated. After the announcement, lawmakers of the ruling African National Congress began to sing and dance in celebration. However, the opposition Economic Freedom Fighters Party walked out of Parliament before a vote could take place. Party leader Julius Malema said his party does not want to legitimize Ramaphosa's election. He is calling for Parliament to be dissolved and early elections to be held. The unusual situation came hours after former President Jacob Zuma told the country on national television that he was stepping down. Zuma's 9 years in office had been marked by many accusations of corruption. Zuma had wanted to delay his resignation until June. However, ANC members said they would hold a no-confidence vote in Parliament Thursday if he did not resign immediately. Ramaphosa served as deputy president under Zuma. He was expected to succeed him after being elected president of the ANC in December. The new president has been active in the ANC since he became a student activist while studying law in the 1970s. For his activities, he was arrested in 1974 and jailed for nearly a year in solitary confinement. Then, he became involved in trade unions as a legal way to protest the racially separated government at the time. Later, he formed the National Union of Mine Workers in 1982, which grew to have 300,000 members. A strike in 1987 showed the movement's power to white leaders as international calls for racial equality in the country increased. South Africa was ruled under a system of racial separation known as apartheid. But that system began to come apart as activists led by Nelson Mandela pushed for equality. Ramaphosa became part of a group tasked with moving South Africa to democracy in 1990 after Mandela was released from 27 years in prison. Former President Mandela identified Ramaphosa as a leader in a new generation of activists. He also led the group that wrote the country's new constitution. When Ramaphosa failed to succeed Mandela as president in 1999, he turned to business, where he became one of Africa's richest men. In his business career, he held stakes in McDonald's and Coca-Cola local businesses. He made millions of dollars in deals that required investors to partner with non-white shareholders in South Africa. However, a miners' strike that turned violent in 2012 hurt his popularity. Police killed 34 miners at the Marikana Platinum Mine. Ramaphosa had been a director of the company at the time. In recent years, Ramaphosa re-entered politics and became deputy president in 2014. However, as deputy to Zuma, he had been criticized for not speaking out against the president. Ramaphosa has promised to rebuild the country's economy, increase growth, and create jobs. South Africa is considered one of the BRICS nations, an association of five major developing economies that includes Brazil, Russia, India, and China. The country hosted the 2010 FIFA World Cup with hopes that the international sports event would bring tourism, trade, and expansion. But the nation of more than 50 million people has struggled with weak economic growth and high unemployment of over 25% for years. I'm Mario Ritter.
When English speakers talk about time and place, there are three little words that often come up: in, on, and at. These common words are prepositions that show a relationship between two words in a sentence. Some prepositions are rather easy for English learners to understand. Behind, over, under, next to, etc. But these little two-letter prepositions seem to create confusion. Here are a few rules to help you understand when to use in, on, and at in a sentence. For describing time and place, the prepositions in, on, and at go from general to specific.
Let's start by looking at how we talk about time. English speakers use in to refer to a general, longer period of time, such as months, years, decades, or centuries. For example, we say in April, in 2015, or in the 21st century. Moving to shorter, more specific periods of time, we use on to talk about particular days, dates, and holidays. You may hear, "I went to work on Monday," or "Let's have a picnic on Memorial Day." For the most specific times, and for holidays without the word day, we use at. That means you will hear, "Meet me at midnight," or "The flowers are in bloom at Easter time."
When English speakers refer to a place, we use in for the largest or most general places. You can say that VOA is located in Washington, D.C., and for the best food, try the restaurants in Chinatown. For more specific places, like certain streets, we use the preposition on. You may know that President Barack Obama lives on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. Finally, we get to the most specific places. For exact addresses or intersections, we use the preposition at. If I invited you to visit us here at VOA, I would say, "Come to my office at 330 Independence Avenue. To be exact, it's at the corner of Independence and 3rd Street.
In English, though, there's always an exception to the rule. When talking about transportation, things get a little hard to understand. We use on for public vehicles, like buses or trains, but also for smaller ones, like a bicycle. I rode there on my bicycle. However, you ride in a car. Still, it helps to know that English prepositions do have some rules. Following the general to specific rule should help you most of the time. I'm Jill Robbins.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the 1820s, in the state of New York, a man named Joseph Smith started the Mormon religion. Smith based it on what he said were God's words to the ancient people of America. Many people became members of the new church. Others, however, laughed at some of the beliefs of the Mormons. This led to trouble. Smith had to move his people many times. For a while, they settled in the state of Illinois, in a town they built and called Nauvoo. The church split when Joseph Smith said that Mormons could have more than one wife. The split led to violence and public opposition to the Mormons. Smith was arrested and put in jail. A mob attacked the jail and killed Smith and his brother. The governor of Illinois ordered the Mormons to leave the state. This week on our series, Sarah Long and Richard Rail discuss relations between the Mormons and the federal government.
Brigham Young became the new leader of the Mormons. He told his people that he had seen their new home in a dream. He said it was a wide, beautiful valley in the west. He said he would recognize it when he saw it. The Mormons left Illinois in the spring of 1846. There were more than 15,000 people and many wagons and farm animals. The trip west was hard. Many of the people died. After months of slow travel, they stopped to make their winter camp.
Explorers visited the camp. They told Brigham Young about a great salt lake in a wide valley on the western side of the Rocky Mountains. From the way they described it, Young believed it was the valley of his dream. He started to move his people toward the Great Salt Lake as soon as the winter snows melted. They arrived in the summer of 1847. Brigham Young looked out over the valley. "This," he said, "is the right place."
The Mormons wasted no time. 2 hours after arriving, they began to prepare the ground for planting. The lake water was too salty to use, so they built a system of canals to bring water down from the mountains. The first few years were difficult. Cold weather and insects destroyed their crops. Yet the Mormons continued to work hard to make their settlement a success. They refused to think of leaving.
At first, the Mormons were ruled only by the laws of their church and by their leader. Then gold was discovered in California. Many non-Mormons passed through the Salt Lake area on their way to the gold fields. Some of them stayed. It soon became clear that new laws were needed to govern the growing population. The Mormons asked Congress to approve a territorial government for their land. They called the land Deseret. That was a Mormon word meaning honeybee. The Mormons claimed a large area. It stretched from the mountains of Colorado west to the mountains of California, from Arizona north to Oregon.
Congress rejected the large claim of Deseret and made it a much smaller territory. It also refused to accept the name Deseret. Instead, Congress called it Utah, after the Ute tribe of Native American Indians that lived there. As a compromise, Brigham Young was named governor of the new Utah Territory. Most of the new territorial officials were Mormons, too. Four were not Mormon.
Governing the territory would not be easy. There were disputes during the administrations of several American presidents. As a result of one dispute, the four non-Mormon officials returned to Washington. The Mormons then formed their own territorial government with a legislature and courts. Other federal officials were sent to Utah. Some of them were not prepared for the job. Usually, they did not stay long.
Some of the officials made many charges against Brigham Young and other Mormon leaders. They said Mormons refused to recognize the power of the federal government. They said Mormons put the words of Young above the laws of Congress. They said the church had a secret organization to take the lives and property of those who questioned the power of the church. There were charges that Mormons had burned the papers of the Supreme Court of the territory. And there were charges that Mormons were responsible for Indian attacks on some officials. President Franklin Pierce decided he should make someone else governor of Utah. The man he chose, however, did not want the job. Instead, he urged the president to let Brigham Young remain. President Pierce agreed.
Relations between the Mormons and the government did not improve in the next 3 years. Territorial officials resigned. They charged that the Mormons were in open rebellion against the federal government. The next president, James Buchanan, dismissed Brigham Young as governor. He ordered more than 1,000 soldiers to go to Utah to put down the rebellion. He also sent a new governor, Alfred Cumming, with the soldiers. The Mormons prepared to fight. A small group of Mormon men attacked and destroyed the army's supply wagons. They forced the soldiers to stop for the winter before reaching the Salt Lake Valley. The soldiers could do nothing until spring.
In Washington, efforts were made to settle the dispute. A man named Thomas Kane asked President Buchanan to let him go to Utah. Kane was an old friend of the president. He also was a friend of the Mormons. He had spent much time with them during their long trip to Utah 10 years earlier. Kane feared what might happen to his Mormon friends if fighting started. He told President Buchanan that he did not want a job or money. He only wanted a chance to be useful. The president agreed to let him try to settle the dispute.
Thomas Kane arrived in Salt Lake City, the territorial capital, early in 1858. He found that the Mormons had decided not to fight. Instead, they were preparing to search for a new home. They talked of moving to Mexico, or perhaps to an island in the South Pacific. Kane talked with Brigham Young. Then he went to the army camp to talk with Governor Cumming. The governor agreed to go to Salt Lake City with Kane. The two men went alone, without any soldiers.
The Mormons welcomed Cumming, but continued their preparations to leave. Cumming called a public meeting. He said he was in Utah to represent the federal government. He said he was there to make sure the people of the territory obeyed the Constitution and the laws of the United States. He said he would not use military force until every other way had failed. Above all, said Cumming, he would not interfere with the Mormon religion. He urged the Mormons not to leave the land they had worked so hard to build. Brigham Young agreed to stay.
Governor Cumming returned to the army camp. He told the commander that the Mormons had accepted him. He said military force would not be needed. A few days later, two representatives of President Buchanan arrived. They brought news that the president would not act against Mormons who accepted the rule of the United States government. Brigham Young and the other Mormon leaders made a statement. They said they wished to live in peace under the Constitution and the laws of the United States. The dispute was over. Brigham Young continued to lead the Mormon Church, but the governor ruled the territorial government. The two jobs were separate and would remain that way.
Congressional elections were held in the United States in 1858. One political race created national interest. It was for one of the two Senate seats representing the state of Illinois. The candidate of the Democratic Party was Stephen Douglas. He was running for re-election. His opponent was a lawyer and a member of the Republican Party. His name was Abraham Lincoln. That will be our story next time.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.